Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Thank you for downloading or streaming this episode of Band Biographies. You can find more episodes at bandbiographies.com. That's B-A-N-N-E-D biographies.com. If you enjoy it, why not leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts? Apparently, it helps get the show up the charts so more people can see it, to download it, and then to leave further 5-star reviews. Another way you can help is by telling as many friends as possible to give it a download. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, on Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. But most of all, enjoy. Hello, and welcome to this special interview episode of the Band Biographies podcast, a proud member of the Pantheon Network of music podcasts. I'm Tom Austin Morgan, your host, and on this episode, I'm talking to Will Crewdson. Will is a London-based guitarist, writer, and producer whose solo act, Scant Regard, produces a hybrid of Western-style twanging guitars and full-on electronic wizardry. He also plays in the rock bands She Made Me Do It and Rachel Stamp, in which he spent 10 years touring and recording. Rachel Stamp were, or probably are, and always will be, the only unsigned band to sell out the London Astoria and play gigs with, amongst others, Iggy Pop, Korn, No Doubt, The Tubes and Cheap Trick. Over the years, he's also worked with US singer Jeanette Napolitano, Flesh for Lulu, Chiefs of Relief, The Selector, Bow Wow Wow, Zig Zig Sputnik Electronic, and has collaborated with US director and film writer Tom DeCillo as one half of the Black and Blue Orchestra. He's also done session work with Malcolm McLaren, Tom Jones, Brian Ferry, Peter Murphy of Bauhaus, Westworld, Celine Dion, Appleton, Pigface, Tyler James, Livan, T-Rextacy, Billy Bragg, and Dragons. I saw him playing lead guitar with Adam Ant, who he's been playing with on and off since 2010, on Sunday the 4th of September. The next day, I messaged him about coming on the podcast, and he responded straight away. And here we are, recording on Tuesday morning. Will was really great to talk to, and as you've heard, has worked with a who's who of musicians. He's the second of the Ant family of musicians to have appeared on this podcast now, with Chris Constantino, or Chris De Niro, appearing recently. The thing they both have in common is a broad range of musical tastes and acts they've played with, and an amazing sense of style. Just go and Google them. Anyway, before I start repeating a bunch of things I covered with him on the episode, you can find Will Crewdson on Twitter and Facebook as Will Crewdson, on Instagram as Scant Regard, and on his website scantregard.com to keep up to date with who he's playing with and where. So without further ado, I present my conversation with Will Crewdson. Will Crewdson, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's only about 36 hours ago, 37 hours ago, that I saw you closing out a set with Adam Ant, shredding the hell out of your guitar on the track Physical during the last song of the night. So it's been a bit of a whirlwind.
Yeah.
How has the tour been so far with Adam? Because I know it's been a little bit kind of disrupted at the very beginning in March. It was postponed for a couple of months. And then halfway through, Adam caught COVID as well, which actually on the same day I caught COVID, we were supposed to see him in a couple of nights and we both came down with COVID on the same day.
All right. COVID synchronization.
Yeah.
Nice. Like you say, it's been a bit stop start, but when we've actually been doing it, it's been going really well. Probably one of the best tours I've done with him, I would say. I don't know if that's to do with the set list or just the fact that we haven't played for a while, you know, and it's just always a release after a couple of years of not playing to go on tour and do all those songs. So I guess it's a combination of them, of both that. But yeah, well, the actual gigs we've done have been really good, and I think we're sounding better than ever. Yeah.
Mm. No, I thought it was an amazing show. I thought it was because I haven't been to many gigs that I haven't played in since opening back up again, because it's all about trying to catch up with what you were doing beforehand, isn't it?
That's right.
Because you guys were doing like full album tours, weren't you? You were doing like Friend or Foe before this, right?
That was the tour before, yeah. It was the whole Friend or Foe album, which we did over here out in the States, yeah.
Mm. Did you get that completed before COVID?
Yeah, that was actually 2019.
Oh, right.
Okay. We finished that. So that was well before, you know, well before we knew about it anyway. Mm,
yeah. Well, yeah. Has it kind of, because you've just released your EP, Fuckify, A Scant Regard. So.
Yeah, Fuckify on all platforms now, even though I said it wasn't going to be.
Oh, so were you an anti-Spotify or something like that?
Oh, I don't know. It's just, I just quite like the idea of playing with the words, really. And I wanted to. And I did put it out for a couple of months without going to the digital platforms, but now it's everywhere. So, yeah.
So anyway,
what a hypocrite.
But it's all about trying to get it out there to as many people as possible, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like listening to myself, and it's easier for me. So.
Yeah. Brilliant. So you released it a couple of months previously anyway, because it went online July?
I guess so. Yeah, it was kind of when we started the tour. Mm. I just put it out a week before that. Yeah.
Mm. So is like, yeah. Has the tour been pushed back? Has that kind of got in the way of any kind of promotion that you do for that, or do you not do a lot of promotion as Scant Regard?
Well, it's basically all me, you know, which I can do online. I can do that anywhere. So it's kind of easier on tour, if anything, because there's a lot more people looking at everything I post, you know. So. That makes it a good thing, really, sort of positive thing.
Oh, fair play. Cool. But yeah, I gave that a listen and it seems like a lot more electronic than some of the other stuff that you've done, which kind of mixes rock and electronica. This is almost purely electronic, I'd say. So is that a kind of conscious decision that you've want to move in that direction?
I don't know. I don't really think about it with my solo stuff. I love electronic music. I mean, I think there's guitar on nearly all the tracks, yeah, but there might not be as much. So I can understand why it might sound a bit more electronic than the normal stuff. But I think if you listen to, even right back to when I started about 10 years ago, the first album, that's pretty, you know, there's quite a lot of synths and beats going on that. So I've always tried to incorporate that, yeah. But I have actually recently I've been thinking maybe I've been thinking about doing maybe something different with just electronica and not guitars. So maybe it's kind of, that's the natural thing that will be next. Who knows? But I like to play live, you know, so I play guitar. So I kind of have to incorporate that.
Yeah. We're going to talk about quite a few of the bands that you're involved with. But I assume that you've got quite broad tastes in music anyway. And I guess Scant Regard is where you can kind of smash a couple of those influences together.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's, and like I say, because it's guitar and electronic based, you know, and I'm into a lot of guitar bands, a lot of electronic bands, it's kind of that pushes it even further, sort of pushes the kind of amalgamation aspect of it even further, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
And before we get there, we should do the kind of obligatory kind of getting to know you questions. So what was the first song you remember hearing that made you think, oh, I want to pick up an instrument and try and make a career in music? Was it ever a conscious thought to become a full-time musician?
Well, it actually, what originally I did classical music, and I wasn't particularly listening to classical music too much before that, but that was kind of my introduction to music in general, you know. So it's quite hard to say what kind of it's quite hard to say a specific song or anything, because obviously you hear stuff on the radio. But yeah, it was kind of, I think the earliest sort of musical memory for me was going to see Fantasia, the Disney film. Right. And that's purely classical, you know. So yeah, kind of that was the original thing. But obviously that doesn't make you think you want to play in a band, does it? So that came later, I think, when I was a teenager, really, yeah.
Mm. Well, Fantasia is one of those like gateway things, I think, for a lot of young people who are into music, because it combines Disney and amazing music as well, and it puts it to those really kind of trippy visuals.
Yeah,
I think it's an amazing movie. I've not seen the 2000 one, the Fantasia 2000 that they brought out a few years back.
No.
But I remember watching Fantasia a lot as a kid, and also having that kind of like, I don't even know really what's going on, but it's a cool experience.
Yeah, I don't think they knew what was going on either, but you know, it worked. It worked visually.
Yeah.
The music worked, definitely, yeah.
What was your first instrument then, if you were playing classical?
Well, I had piano lessons first for a couple of years, and then I had guitar lessons after that. So I did all my classical grades and all that, and I went to the Royal Academy of Music while I was still at school. I was doing that on Saturdays.
So
I did that till I was about 16. But yeah, piano was the original instrument.
And I suppose, you know, that classical training in piano especially kind of plays into the electronica stuff as well, because it's all keys and synth based. Is there a way that you can kind of bring that into kind of writing the Scant Regard stuff? Do you use specific non-pop based chords and augmentations and stuff like that? Or
I don't think about it that way, but I'm sure that is, I'm sure that influences it. You know, it's always there, isn't it? I think however you learn, the basis of how you sort of expand what you're doing is always going to be there. So I'm sure that is there, but I don't play keyboards anymore. Really. It's kind of all programmed. So it's more likely I'll have an idea in my head and then just, you know, get it down without having to play it manually, you know.
Right
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things, I've never tried doing electronic music. I'm merely a bassist, so I play all sorts of four string instruments, you know, electric bass, stand-up bass, that kind of thing. I dabble a little bit in drums, so I'm kind of the rhythm section guy, but I've never kind of gone into electronic music, so it's an area that I don't massively understand how it's made, I guess. So what's the difference in programming synth lines and melodies there?
Well, you can just sort of do it step by step if you need to, you know. I'd probably more likely do it that way than actually sit there and play as if I was playing the piano, you know. You can just program stuff in and then quantize it, because I like that mechanical feel, you know. And then I guess the guitar parts I add on to it, and they create more of a human feel over it, you know. So that's kind of the way it works with me, yeah.
Right. Did you grow up in a musical household growing up? Were your parents into music, or do you have brothers and sisters, and were they playing music as well?
I grew up, I didn't have any brothers and sisters around when I was growing up, but I had two parents though. They were both in the theatre, actually. My dad was an actor before I was born, actually. So he was an actor, and my mother was a ballet dancer, so that's how they met. So it's kind of more like the showbiz tradition rather than purely musical, you know. But I guess that's what encouraged them to want to encourage me to do something in the arts, you know, in general.
So you could kind of see, you know, my parents have done this, therefore it is attainable.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I think you need to see that to realize that you can make a living out of doing it, maybe, or like to see the hard work that goes into it, I suppose, as well, or to understand the hard work that went into their careers.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think that's what happened, really. Yeah.
So what was the first single or album that you bought with your own money?
First album I bought was The Jungle Book. which looking back, it's actually pretty cool because there was so much jazz on that. And I still listen to jazz today, you know. So yeah, that was the first album. First single I bought was Ghost Town by The Specials.
Fair enough. That's pretty cool as well.
So that's, yeah, I guess, that, yeah, not too embarrassing, really, thankfully.
Yeah. And yeah. Like you say, The Jungle Book's an interesting one because of the jazz kind of connection. And some of those songs on there, you know, like I Want to Be Like You is just like a perennial, really. You can, I think you almost can listen to that without watching the visuals of the film, you know. They're such strong songs.
Yeah, I don't think I'd actually seen the film. I just heard the soundtrack, you know. So I kind of, when I saw the film, I kind of knew all the words because obviously there's loads of dialogue on the soundtrack, you know. Well before Tarantino did that.
Disney was doing it first. So what about the first gig that you went to as a teenager then? Or I mean, I suppose you must have been to quite a few kind of classical and theatrical productions, but what was the first band that you saw live?
Adam and the Ants.
Was it?
And that was before I was a teenager. So I was like 11, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. Prince Charming review at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane. And I went with my mum. My mum took me very nicely. So it's kind of, that was a mega, you know, what the fuck moment, I think, was seeing Adam and the Ants, like, you know, especially that tour, because that was a really theatrical production with costume changes and set changes and everything. And it's about a 3-hour show. So
wow.
It was almost like, a cross between a rock concert and a musical, really, because it was in a theatre as well. So,
wow. Adam looked, especially back in the Prince Charming era, he was like nothing else, really, wasn't he? Dressing like either a pirate or a highwayman, or, you know, I mean, he still dresses the part. He still looks sharp as anything. But at that time, I suppose, as a young boy, seeing him doing his thing like that, he must have looked like, I don't know, some sort of superhero, swashbuckling adventurer, and then with that voice as well.
Exactly, yeah, it's a full package, really. I mean, the thing is, it's like, because you don't know anything else, then you just think, oh, this is what a pop star is, you know. Yeah. And it's kind of like you don't realize till later on how kind of original he was, really, you know, and still is. So, yeah, that kind of comes with hindsight a bit, but pretty mind-blowing to see that, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then years later to actually play music with him must have been a bit of a strange moment when you were, was it 2010 that you first met Adam and kind of joined the group?
That was when I first started playing with him, but I'd known him, I actually met him in the 90s when my old man Rachel Stamp was still going. We had a couple of meetings with him and he came. He came and did a few songs with us at one gig with Marco. But yeah, 2010 was when I first started playing guitar with him, yeah.
So how did you find that, playing guitar in the band of a guy that was, you know, the first pop star that you'd ever seen live?
It was just really surreal, you know, especially like that first rehearsal where I was just, I mean, he just let me just play any Ant songs that I wanted to play. And I just said, oh, okay, we'll do Lady now. We'll do Young Frisians, whatever, you know. And he just sung along with it. And it was just like, oh, this is just like the most amazing karaoke night ever, basically. You know? Maybe that's not the right word for it, but it sounded a bit better than the normal karaoke. But incredible. It's still surreal, you know, especially, like I said, we just had quite a bit of a gap between tours and just coming back and doing it again. It's like, oh my God, you know, I'm playing the best songs with like my favorite singer. And it's just, unbelievable.
It's the first time I'd ever seen him live the other day at Brighton.
Oh, really?
And like my other half is a massive Adam Ant fan, but she'd never seen him live. And so I got the tickets as soon as they went on sale. And yeah, as I say, kind of it got pushed back the first time. Then the second time we both had COVID.
Right.
So it's been 6 months and getting to see him for the first time, especially for her, was a massive deal.
Okay.
But previously I knew the hits before I met Jo. And since meeting her, she's kind of inducted me into
kind of ant fandom, if you like. And yeah, it was a great show. I think like he's got an interesting way of moving across the stage, which has always been there. You know, you watch the old footage of him and he's got that very staccato movement across the stage, lots of spinning and all that. But what amazed me was kind of the depth and breadth when all of the kind of the ant stuff from the Dirk Wears White Sox era up to the Prince Charming, and then his solo stuff as well. Like the breadth and depth of music is kind of astounding, really. And like every single one is a banger.
Yeah. No, it's true.
Can't imagine what it's like to play like that kind of set, really.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of any other artists that, I mean, obviously there are artists, you know, you could say like David Bowie changed his style with every album and all that, you know. But really, I think Adam, it was like it was the most extreme that I can think of, you know, for someone that put out so many albums. It's quite incredible, you know, and then literally from year to year, it would completely change the style, and you can't really sort of put any of those eras together. You know, you wouldn't be able to sort of make one album you wouldn't be able to make it as coherent as the albums are themselves, if you see what I mean, you know, because that it's so eclectic. Yeah. And that just makes it so much fun to play, you know, and each tour you don't know what's going to be added, or you know, so it just keeps it really interesting and fresh, you know.
Is there a particular kind of era that you prefer to play, or are there certain songs that are more difficult to play?
I mean, I quite like a bit of a challenge, really. So I guess when we did a tour when we played that, we did two tours actually, where we played the whole Dirk Wears White Sox album, and that's very sort of intricate and very specific parts, the guitar parts especially. So yeah, that's but that was really enjoyable as well, you know, to be able to sort of recreate it, especially when we had Dave Barbarossa on drums, you know, who actually played on the record, you know, so we had the whole, you know, you could just, the whole feel was just perfect, you know. So yeah, so I'd say all that stuff. I really enjoy playing anything off Vive La Rock as well, because that's one of my favorite albums ever.
Yeah,
it's just like, I mean, every song is a banger on that album, you know. It's just a shame it didn't get the recognition it deserved at the time, really. So yeah, but all the early punk stuff as well, you know, the stuff before Dirk is just a joy to play. Yeah.
I think it's nice that he's able to bring those songs back, because I don't know whether they were so well known at the time. It feels like they've had a resurgence since.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain songs, you know, that were sort of early ones that he redid as B-sides. So obviously, you know, I used to always play the B-side of everything. And then, so if you say, you know, if you bought Prince Charming, you'd probably know Red Scat, you know. I think that was on the B-side of that. Beat My Guest is on the B-side of Prince Charming. Okay, I should know that. Red Scab was on Goody Two Shoes. So, yeah, and those are like massive selling singles. So, yeah, but they were like the original punk songs, you know, just redone for the B-sides.
Is he still as driven as ever? Because it seems like he was always one of the most driven of that mid-70s coming out of the punk movement. He seemed to always want to be the biggest and the best out of all those groups. And I think there was a moment where he attained that, you know, just at the end of Prince Charming and then into the very early days of his solo career. He was one of the biggest acts out of the UK, really.
Yeah.
But he always seems to have this drive to push on and be the best at what he does. Is he still, do you still feel that drive from him?
Well, yeah, when it comes to the live shows, and really it's all about the live shows for him these days. So he just always gives it, you know, 1,000%, as you probably saw the other night, you know. So I would say the drive is definitely never gonna go, you know, for that.
No, it's amazing that we were talking on the way home, and it, like, he's still in such great shape physically. He just looks the part. Like, it's an amazing, the light show was incredible as well. You know, I think the whole staging was great. And to be fair, You know, apart from Adam, of course, I think you were one of the other highlights, like the other thing that you couldn't take your eyes off, really. Like, your presence on stage, I thought, was incredible. Like, your look was great.
Oh, thanks.
And what's the guitar that you use? Is it a Gretsch?
I couldn't see. It's actually a Hagstrom. Which I got at the start of this tour, actually. I just got it this year. And it's just been incredible. It's kind of, I've got quite a few guitars, and it's sort of making them all redundant, really, because it's just love it so much. So I was using that for most of the show, and I've been using it for, I'm sure I'll be using it for years to come, you know.
My friend Paul, who I play in a couple of bands with, he's got a couple of Hagstroms, and he basically doesn't play anything else now. He loves those things.
Right. There you go. Yeah.
So is that, you know, what was the first guitar you ever bought, and kind of what has been the guitar of choice over the years?
The first guitar I bought was actually a semi-acoustic thing. It was an Epiphone Sheraton.
Mm.
I've always loved sort of big sort of, 50s looking guitars. So I got that, and I don't know what happened to that. I think I swapped it for something probably a lot less value. I ended up with that, and that probably broke the usual. So that was the first guitar I got. Yeah.
You mentioned Rachel Stamp earlier on, and I remember listening to them in the kind of late 90s when I was getting into kind of alternative music for the first time, and just loving that kind of glam, slightly sleazy rock, hard rock sound.
Right.
I mean, were you in any bands before that, or was that your first band?
No, I was in bands for a few years before Rachel Stamp, but that was the first band that where we actually got signed and put out stuff, you know.
Mm.
I had a few bands. I mean, the first band I ever did, I kind of wrote everything, and I had my best friend who was the singer, and I wrote all the lyrics and the, you know, the melodies and the songs, basically. So I was doing that for a few years, but I was never that comfortable with that. I always wanted to kind of collaborate. So when I met David, the singer from Rachel Stamp, we just hit it off, and we had all the same kind of influences, and that worked out really well. And yeah, we got signed and all that. So we did that for about 10 years, pretty much, loads of touring.
And it's true that you were the first unsigned band to sell out the Astoria, right?
That's right. I think we're the first signed band to headline Astoria. Yeah.
Wow.
Probably the only.
Yeah.
The only one, actually, because it's not even there anymore. So, so that was cool. We played there a couple of times, actually. Yeah.
I used to love the Astoria. It's one of those, you know, one of those kind of hallowed places in London, isn't it? That had a real reputation as the place that you wanted to play.
Yeah. Pretty sad that that's gone. There's actually a video of it being demolished on YouTube. If you really feel like too happy, you know, just watch that.
Yeah, no, not anytime soon, I don't think.
No.
Are Rachel Stamp still a going concern? I was checking on the Wikipedia earlier on, and it still says present. Do you guys?
No, we still play. Yeah, we actually played a couple of months ago at the Garage, and that went really well. So every so often we'll do a London gig, but it looks like we might be trying to put a tour together for next year.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that comes off. I mean, when we're all around, you know, we're all quite busy with other stuff, but we do that. I'd personally like to do some new stuff, you know, because every time we do a comeback show, we play all the old stuff, which is great, you know, but I'd like to kind of try and move it forward a bit. Yeah. So maybe there'll be new material as well to go with this tour.
That'd be pretty cool. I'd like to hear what a kind of updated version of that sound would be, actually.
Yeah.
What was going to be one of my other questions, actually, kind of what's the secret to the longevity of that band when so many of the members have loads of other projects that they do? Because I know that you play, obviously, with Robin Guy, who's in the other Sham 69.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he obviously does a lot with Sham 69. That's quite ongoing for him. So, and David's got his solo stuff he does, and he works with a few other people. So, but you know, it's really, as I say, all we've been doing is kind of one-off kind of reunion shows over the last 10 years, pretty much.
Mm.
So it hasn't been too much of a problem, but we'll see when we try and get this tour together, we'll see if it actually will practically work, you know, before we can actually do it.
And I guess as you're looking at doing a tour, like there's still a kind of, there's still a big enough fan base out there for you to kind of put one of those on.
Yeah, well, all the, every time we play London, it's always like really busy, and there's still like a real enthusiasm for the band. You know, I suppose it's kind of in that kind of nostalgia thing at this point, you know, because people remember in the 90s, like it was the halcyon days or whatever. So there's a bit of that, which is fine. You know, it's kind of weird though, because it's like, I mean, I love, like I was talking about playing with Adam, and I love playing all his stuff is obviously, you know, decades old, you know, and I don't mind at all. But it's kind of weird when you're playing your own stuff that you played back then and you're still playing. It's kind of like, you know, this is why I just kind of want to let it move on a bit and do some new stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I kind of understand. Like I just got my very first band back together last year, and the view was to make it a covers band because, you know, we're in that era of our lives now, but we've been playing more original shows this year than we have done covers shows. And again, yeah, playing songs that we've written when we were 18, 19, 20, but we took a long time off and all did other things. And then, yeah, playing these songs that we wrote the best part of two decades ago, it is a bit weird. Like I've got a little glimpse into that kind of life, but it's only out of necessity because, again, we haven't written anything new. Because also I play in the other Sham 69, and that is, again, playing songs that are decades old. But yeah, they're not my songs, so I don't have the personal connection to it. But I can imagine it's a bit strange, and I know now that it's a bit strange playing your old stuff that you've written yourself.
That's it. Yeah, well, you've had the whole experience, so yeah.
Yeah, it's very odd. I guess, like, I mean, just looking through your website, because when I emailed you yesterday morning, you replied back to me before I'd even got off your site, and it was basically because I was looking through the number of artists that you've worked with. And the list is as long as your arm. People like, I mean, appearing in a video with Tom Jones, a gig with Celine Dion, a recording session with Brian Ferry, Peter Murphy from Bauhaus. And then, you know, this, you got the Appleton sisters and Lee Ryan in there as well. I mean, tell me a little bit about how some of those came about. Like, what's the story behind some of those?
Well, most of those that you mentioned were kind of all around the same time, which is about 20 years ago now. And that was when I had an agent that was getting, it was kind of like towards the end of Rachel Stamp. And the first thing I got as an actual session job was Tom Jones. And that was a load of TV stuff. And I think after that was when I started working with Appleton. Again, that was TV stuff. And the Celine Dion thing came after that. So yeah, it was all through an agent that I had at that time, really. And then obviously, you know, you get a bit known for doing these things, and you know, you make friends with people that are working with other people, and just happened like that, really. Yeah.
And when you're a session musician, I assume you just get given the songs that are going to be played on the night to learn, probably in a short amount of time, and then kind of, you don't work too closely with those artists, or am I wrong?
Well, there's it depends. I mean, some of those gigs we didn't actually play live, you know, but with Appleton we did some festivals and stuff, so we were rehearsing quite a bit for that. So obviously you're hanging out with people, rehearsing, you know, for a week or so. I remember that was at that point, one of them was with, I don't know if she's married to him, but she was with Liam.
That's right.
And he used to turn up and just watch us rehearse and stuff like that. So that was cool. But yeah, that was a name drop, wasn't it? I just name dropped. I'll try not to do that again. I didn't do it before that, and I won't do it again. But yeah, no, that just kind of sprung in my head.
But they were tabloids. They were kind of tabloid darlings at the time, weren't they? You know, he was clearly going to be around at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, yeah. But yeah, no, it depends on who we're talking about. Because with Tom Jones, you know, he would literally just turn up and sing and then leave, you know. So did hang around with him a bit. I think we went to Germany and did like Top of the Pops in Germany.
Oh, right.
So I sort of had a few talks with him there. He was talking about how long my guitar strap was. And yeah.
I suppose he's used to working with those kind of the guys who play the guitar up here under their chin.
I guess so, yeah. But he was saying, oh, that's the longest strap I've seen since. He said, oh, that's it. He was telling me the first person to do that was the guy from that Scottish band. Oh, Alex Harvey band.
All right.
I can't remember the guitarist's name, but yeah, there was that guy who had like white hero face paint. And apparently and I said, oh, are you sure it wasn't it Jimmy Page before that? You know, he's going, no, it was this guy. You know, so that was cool. Yeah. That's what I remember about Tom anyway.
I mean, he always like from watching him on the TV and stuff, he always seems like he's full of stories anyway, whether, and you often think with some of these guys, whether it's half remembered or mythologized, you know?
Yeah, you never can tell. But I think he's got his head screwed on, you know, Tom, yeah. I think he knows.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
He seems to know his stuff, definitely yeah. About rock and roll. You know, I mean, like he was friends with Elvis, you know.
So. I mean, you can't get more rock and roll than that, can you?
No, absolutely. Yeah.
And I mean, were any of them, that you know, any of those guys that, you know, I mentioned there, were you surprised at some of their work ethics? Like, were some of them harder workers than you imagined that they would be? Or were some of them less hard workers? You know, were they not as on it as you thought they might have been?
No, I mean, I can't think of anyone that didn't work hard. That I mean, and obviously that's how they got there, you know.
Yeah.
So just ultra professional, all these people. You know, I'm not just saying that. It's just I literally can't think of any problems. I can't think of anyone turning up late or doing things that particularly would make them look amateur. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, everyone was dead on it. Yeah.
But like Celine Dion wasn't too much of a diva or anything like that.
No, I mean, I didn't really hang out with her. She literally just turned up, and she always seemed very friendly. You know, always said hello, but that was about it with her. Yeah, I think I hung out more with her husband, her late husband. Yeah, yeah.
It's just an incredible list of people, really. You know, I mean, what was Brian Ferry like to work with as well? Did you do a home recording with him or something like that?
No, that was kind of weird, because that was it wasn't actually a session. It was kind of an audition for his band, but it was in his studio in Olympia. So I kind of spent the whole afternoon there going over his songs and he was watching me play. And he was like showing me around the studio, which was really cool. And then there was supposed to be a gig after that, which they couldn't get me a visa for in time. And then there was nothing after that. So I didn't actually do a gig with him, but I did spend that afternoon in his studio. Yeah. So that's what happened with that.
I can imagine he's quite a cool guy to hang out with, because he's the guy who basically influenced the whole kind of, I guess even Adam Ant himself was influenced by Brian Ferry and Roxy Music. Like, they were such a massive inspiration to a lot of the punks at that time.
Very much, yeah, because they were kind of out there on their own, weren't they? And especially image-wise as well. You know, that was a very strong thing, you know, and not in the sort of glam way like T-Rex or The Sweet. They were very, I wouldn't say more stylish, but very more original, I thought, yeah, doing their own thing. It came from more of an art school thing, didn't it, Roxy Music?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, quite experimental musically. So, yeah, definitely, that was... very influential on a lot of the punk bands, yeah, like you say.
And I mean, when you're, you know, having a chat with these people, is there anything that you can kind of glean off them that, I don't know, you can, is there like an inspiration after kind of, you know, jamming with them or playing with them or whatever, that you can kind of take to other projects? Do you know what I mean?
Definitely, yeah. I get, again, you know, like I said before, it's kind of like I think it's just like it happens naturally, you know, stuff like that. You just like, for instance, I did a lot of gigs with The Selector over the years, which is completely different from Adam's music, but I was kind of doing one tour with The Selector, one tour with Adam, and definitely, absolutely, you know, certain things from The Selector, like your rhythm playing, just goes right up there, you know, probably the best I've ever been able to play rhythm. And then when you go back to Adam, it's like, oh yeah, this is like, you know, I'm using the chops. I hate that word, chops. Anyway, the chops I gained with The Selector, you're kind of using them with that, you know. And then, you know, you might work with someone where you're doing particularly more backing vocals than with someone else. And then you go back to the other person and it's like a lot easier, because you've kind of, you're in really great voice, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, so it's not even just mental stuff, it's like, you know, physically getting better at certain things with some bands. What you can take them to another band and put them into practice with them, and it's just big, it just makes everything better, really. Yeah.
And The Selector is another band that I absolutely love. Was that the Pauline Black one, or was it Neil Davis's?
I know it's Pauline and Japs from the original band. I did that for about 5 or 6 years, I think. Yeah, great. I mean, I'd never played ska music before, you know, so that was a real cool new thing to do at the time, you know. And like I said, hopefully I brought that sensibility to the other stuff I did a bit, you know.
Yeah. Ska is a totally different way of, was it a lot of the upstroke kind of stuff that I guess you've never done before?
Yeah, no, that's like the rhythm parts are all kind of like that on the offbeats. Yeah. So, which is, yeah, I'm used to playing on the on beats, and suddenly I'm playing on all the offbeats, you know. so you just have to adapt to that. And the drummer we had was amazing. This guy, Winston Marche, it's like solid as a rock, you know. So it was a great band, you know, great band to play with, yeah. And we did loads of touring, you know, we did like loads of Europe, and we went to Colombia and
wow,
Mexico and stuff, all over the States. We supported Rancid. Oh, I dropped another name, sorry.
That's pretty awesome though. drop names all you want. The first musical director role that you got was with Jeanette Napolitano, the lead singer of Concrete Blonde, right, in 2005. Yeah. Did that come off the back of session work? Were you looking for a new challenge? And what exactly is it that a musical director does?
I was a massive fan of her and Concrete Blonde. And I actually bumped into her in London in a record shop a few years before that. Now, I kept in touch with her. I think I went to see her play when she came over here. And I just put it to her. That was, I just put it to her. I said, oh, are you interested in writing? You know, because she wasn't doing Concrete Blonde at the time. And she said, yeah, send me some stuff. I sent her some instrumentals. And she just immediately came up with loads of stuff. And we ended up getting a deal and put out an album around that time. But yeah, as far as musical director goes, it was kind of like the only sort of steady band members you had was a drummer over there, which is kind of more of a session thing that he was doing. So it was kind of like I was the only person in the band, really. So I guess I was sort of directing myself more than anything, you know. So it's kind of by default that I was the direct musical director, I'd have thought, really. But yeah, I produced that album, you know, so it was just quite natural that when we played live, I would sort of arrange stuff and all that, yeah.
So it's more like it's the member of the band with the most input into the musical direction of either the live content or what's going on the album.
Yeah, typically when you're a musical director, you have a band you're working with, and you kind of call the shots, you know. You're like, you're going to sort of be in charge of how things are arranged musically for live or recording, really. Yeah, so that's the job, really. Yeah.
Because you MD'd for Adam as well when you first joined the band, or after a little while after that?
Yeah. No, that was pretty much when I first joined, because there was a lot of different people in the band at that point. I was kind of like, I think I was probably the only person that was the mainstay that year, pretty much. Mm. So, especially, particularly that first gig, might be the second gig we did at the Scala. I was kind of like in charge of, the band, really. So, yeah, I guess I was the MD.
Because Andy, the drummer, is the MD now, isn't he?
No, we don't actually have an MD.
Is there not? Okay, right.
No, it's kind of a democracy, I guess, you know.
Okay.
It works well, because we're all, we all know each other really well. We've been doing it for years. So, Tom Edwards, who died, sadly, about 5 years ago now, he was the appointed MD after I left for a little bit. And when I came back, he still was. But then when he died, yeah, we didn't really feel the need for anyone to be in charge, really, of that. So we just get things done like that, like a democracy, really. Yeah.
Mm. I always found it quite strange that someone with such a kind of clear direction on their career and music as Adam almost required an MD, really. So I always kind of assumed that he would be the one calling the shots. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think probably when he first started out, it was more like that, yeah. But I would think even in the 80s, even towards the end, I think Marco kind of was more like the MD, really.
True.
When he was doing all that solo stuff, and he had like a massive band at that point, didn't he? He had like horns and everything. So yeah, that was more Marco's job, I think, at the time.
Good point. I hadn't thought of that. But you also organised the Matthew Ashman tribute concert as well, right, in 2010.
Yeah.
And then also played in three of the bands that were on that night. What, Bow Wow Wow, Chiefs of Relief, and Adam's band as well. Like, how on earth did you manage that? That seems like a massive undertaking.
It wasn't too bad. I mean, like, they're quite short sets, you know. So the Bow Wow Wow thing was about half an hour, you know. It's quite challenging to play that stuff, though. I did, like, after that, I did bit of touring with Bow Wow Wow, and then so I had to learn all that stuff. And Matthew Ashman is such a brilliant guitarist, and it's quite intricate, all that kind of twangy jungle stuff, you know. But yeah, Chiefs of Relief, I used to go and see them, you know, with Matthew. He was the lead singer at that point after Bow Wow Wow. So I knew those songs really well already. And Billy Morrison just did a brilliant job being Matthew for the night when he... Tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be Matthew. he did lead vocals for Chiefs of Relief, which was great. And it wasn't too bad. Like I say, quite short sets. So, yeah.
And I assume you must have known the guys in those bands previously, or was it just in organizing the gig that you got to know them?
Some of them I'd only just met. The Chiefs of Relief, that was the first time I met Paul Cook, I think, who was on drums. But with Bow Wow Wow, I'd known Lee Gorman for years, actually, before I knew him, before I met Adam, actually. He's the bass player of Bow Wow Wow. So, yeah, he was aware of me already.
Was that also through Rachel Stamp?
No, that was actually before Rachel Stamp. I actually did he used to work a lot with Malcolm McLaren after Bow Wow Wow, and he was going out with someone that I knew around the time he was recording with Malcolm for this soundtrack of Carry On Columbus, which was the last Carry On film. And he needed a guitarist, so my friend said, oh, I know one. And then I went to Air Studio. This is the first time I'd recorded anywhere. I went to Air Studios on Oxford Street. It was like mind-blowing, you know. And Lee was there, put down some stuff. I think I ripped off something. I ripped off a Mudhoney riff or something. Put it on there. It's still on there. If you look up Carry On Columbus, Malcolm McLaren, or whatever it's called, you can hear my guitar on that. And yeah, Malcolm showed up. And I think I got the sack in the middle of the day. I got the sack, but they still use what I did anyway, you know.
Sounds quite Malcolm McLaren to me.
Yeah, exactly. Typical. But yeah, it was an experience, all right, you know. But you know, I was barely a teenager, you know, I was just like, you know, couldn't believe it really.
Yeah. So whereabouts in London did you grow up? Because obviously it seems like you were kind of on the scene. Were you always at gigs and out and about in those areas?
I grew up in the suburbs in Hampton, so wasn't too much going on there. It was barely any gigs at all, really. So I had to go into the West End to do that, and I just couldn't wait, you know, couldn't wait to go to the Marquee or Astoria or wherever, you know. So yeah, so there wasn't anything. There was a venue called the Boatman in Hampton Court that was pretty good, but even that wasn't around the corner, you know. You had to travel a bit. Yeah.
How was working with Malcolm McLaren?
It was pretty intimidating, actually, because I was I don't think he looked me in the, you know, when people don't look you in the eye, they're just kind of talking at you, you know. It was kind of like that a bit, and so I found it quite intimidating. Yeah,
you're never quite sure whether they're addressing you directly or not.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the middle of playing, and his only comment was, "Give it some more bollocks, my son." That was his comment. I remember that. I was like, "Okay, happy to oblige, Mr. McLaren." And I tried my best, and they did. Like I said, they did use what I put on there, so must have done something right.
Clearly.
Yeah. It was quite, I mean, the actual track was quite interesting because it's kind of techno rock kind of mixture of that, and there was all this orchestral stuff on it, you know. So it was I'd never heard anything like it at the time. Pretty groundbreaking, even though the actual film it was for was not groundbreaking at all.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? He always managed to have his ear to the ground and be on the cusp of something new, even if it wasn't maybe obvious at the time. You know, he always was touted as being the person who brought hip hop to the UK, whether he actually was or not, with Buffalo Gals and that kind of stuff.
That's a great record, though, Buffalo Gals. Oh. It's like, still sounds great, isn't it? I mean, so you could say the same thing about David Bowie or something. He knew the people to use around him, and he knew what styles he wanted. And obviously, you know, he wasn't a musician in the same way David Bowie was, but I think all his musical ventures were kind of really original and groundbreaking. Yeah. And he definitely knew how to sort of get the latest trend to the masses, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, an incredible innovator, if not the easiest person to work with. and talking of electronic projects, obviously, along with kind of Scant Regard, you've also done some work with Zig Zig Sputnik Electronic, occasionally as a live guitarist as well. I can imagine Martin Degville's quite an interesting character to work with as well.
Oh, yeah, he's a right one, yeah.
That's the occasional live gig, isn't it?
Yeah, just it's normally like in this country. Oh, actually, I have played with him in Romania, actually, which is cool. But yeah, normally it's just UK stuff because he has a band in Germany anyway, so he does all his European stuff with them. But yeah, that was like one of my favourite bands ever, really, was Zig Zig Sputnik. I just thought they were so, again, groundbreaking. And I always love Neil X's playing. So it's just really cool to play that stuff. And we're playing in December, actually. We're supporting Plopley itself.
Oh, wow.
In December. Yeah, so that'll be a good gig.
Whereabouts is that?
That's at the 229 Club, which is Great Portland Street.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, cool. Hmm. That'll be a night.
Yeah.
So how long have you known Martin?
I've known him about 10 years, I think. I did a solo Scant Regard gig in Wales supporting him. And that was when I had Dave Barbarossa on drums as well.
Okay.
And Martin asked me to come on and play Love Missile at the end. And that went really well. So, he sprung it on me. He's like, oh, let's do Rebel Rebel. I'm like, oh, okay. So I thought, I think I know that riff. So yeah, I managed to do that as well. And then, done loads of stuff with him over the years, you know, one-off stuff normally, you know. Yeah, love it. Love playing that stuff.
Yeah. And again, that band goes back to the origins of punk as well, in a way, with Generation X. And obviously, James was one of the first guitarists there. Yeah, just incredible pedigrees. Weirdly, I've been talking to Dave Barbarossa as well about coming on here.
Mm.
It's like I had Chris De Niro on as well a couple of months ago.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I'm slowly working my way through the Amp family. It's really bizarre how it's working out. It's not conscious, but it's very odd that the people that I found the easiest to kind of get hold of and actually be engaged with are members of the Adam Ant kind of family. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's quite a big family, you know.
Yeah, it is,
So that's quite likely, yeah.
Yeah, because I think Adam back in the day was quite mercenary with his lineup changes and who he would keep on and who he would jettison. Because you guys seem to have kind of kept the core group for a while now. I mean, you've been in the band, obviously you were there 2010 for a while, and then again you've been there since 2014 now.
That's right, yeah, 2014, when we did the Dirt Wears White Socks stuff, yeah.
And I think clearly, like from the show that was on the other night, having that kind of solid base of the same kind of musicians, I know there have been a couple of changes over the last few years, but it feels like it's much more solid, and I think that comes across.
Yeah, no, it's really settled lineup now. And like I said, we all know each other really well, and yeah, we know what we can do and just get it done. Yeah.
Mm. And I guess the other weird thing that kind of comes out of all this is that I've actually been listening to your stuff for about 15 years, because you provide the theme music or the closing theme to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast as Scant Regard.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, that was just last year.
Was it?
Yeah.
I thought he'd been using that music for a while, but maybe he's just updated it.
Yeah, it was literally just last year that because I know his producer quite well, so he'd seen me do my solo stuff live, and he just wanted something like that. He wanted some twangy kind of electronica thing, sci-fi-ish sounding. So I said, oh, okay. I didn't expect him to like it and use it straight away, because normally with things like that, there's a bit of toing and froing, because sometimes people, even if they're involved with adverts or podcasts or whatever, you know, they don't always know what they want until they hear it, you know.
Yeah.
But I just sent that, and he was like, oh yeah, that's perfect. I'm like, oh, okay. I haven't even mixed it yet, you know. But yeah, no, it seemed to have worked like that, so yeah.
Yeah, I wondered whether it was written to order or whether it was like a sample off one of your songs or something like that.
No, it was written to order, yeah, but it was all very, very quick how it came together, that, yeah. So, yeah, it's good. It's quite cool because he does like live ones as well, doesn't he? So you can hear it being blasted out to an audience, which is quite cool, yeah.
Yeah, at the end of every show, it must be pretty cool. Have you done any other kind of things like that for like adverts or podcast stings or anything like that?
Not really, no. I've done a few sort of short films, you know, soundtracks, but I'd really love to get more into that, really, because I always enjoy doing that. Yeah, I work with a director called Tom Schillo a lot, but that was kind of more with his, he wanted to do an actual album with him singing and stuff, so we did an album under the Black and Blue Orchestra.
Okay, yeah,
that's out there somewhere. I'm always interested in working with visual stuff and soundtrack work, yeah. Mm. Really interested, and adverts as well, yeah.
Cool. So I suppose it's more of a challenging brief. You've got an even, especially for adverts and stuff, you've got an even more limited time frame to work with.
That's it, yeah. No, which can be a good thing, yeah. In some ways, the more limited you are, you know, the more you have to be sort of focused and get things done quickly and properly, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing that you're still looking for that kind of thing with all the other stuff that you do. I mean, the other obvious question is, how the hell do you fit it all in?
Well, I mean, it hasn't been that much gigs over the last couple of years, obviously. Well, but before that, it was pretty crazy. Like I said, I was doing Selector and Adam, you know, and literally I'd play in America with a Selector, come back for a day and then go back to America with Adam. You know?
Wow.
It's just, but it managed to work out, you know, in the end. Yeah, you just find a way of making it work, really, yeah.
And I suppose, yeah, kind of talking about the last couple of years, how was that for you? I mean, obviously you can't go out and tour. Did you do any kind of those kind of Zoom gigs, or what was your kind of pandemic like?
It was okay. I mean, I put out two solo albums in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And I was literally playing right up to the pandemic. I was actually in LA playing a solo gig like the week before everything shut down, you know.
Mm.
So I had to kind of get back quick. I had to cancel the rest of my gigs and get back. But and I managed to do, yeah, I did some online stuff. I didn't do it actually live, you know, but I just kind of recorded myself for like a charity thing and things like that. I did my band, She Made Me Do It. We managed to do like a whole set. We went up to Manchester and did that in the middle of lockdown. I don't know how we managed that. probably a bit dodgy, but we did that and then came back, and that's up on the internet somewhere. So yeah, no, I did it because some people said they found it hard to be creative, you know, and I put out two albums that year, so I think I kind of used it to keep busy, you know, and the fact that I can do it from home helps, obviously, as well, you know.
I suppose there's that thing of it's an outlet, you know, it's something, it, because putting out two albums in a year is probably something quite rare as well.
Yeah, I've never done that before. Yeah. Mind you, I haven't put out anything since then, really, apart from this EP.
Mm.
I put out the odd track, but it seems to be working for me better now just to put out EPs and singles, really.
Well, I think that's almost the way that streaming has gone, really. It rewards people who put out little and often, it seems to be.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I guess, I don't know, like, I'm still very much a kind of physical media guy, and I like the long form albums, and I like the process of listening to a whole piece of work in one go, which probably makes me sound incredibly old and old fashioned, but
no, I think I like that as well, you know. I mean, I like, it's definitely quite exciting when you know you've got 10 songs by someone you really like in front of you and just about to listen to them, yeah. And it's still, actually, I was listening to something the other day and I didn't realize it was an EP, you know, and I was just like, oh, why is it finished? You know, so yeah, I guess we're sort of conditioned to the album length, you know, for at least 10 tracks, you know.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? But does streaming come into your mind when you're writing stuff for, I don't know, Scant Regard or She Made Me Do It or any of your own projects? When you're writing songs, do you kind of think about, well, the intro can't be too long because I've got to get to the hook or do you not consider that at all in your songwriting?
No, I'd rather just put another hook in, you know. I think, I just don't, I really don't take that into consideration at all, really. Because in a way, it's kind of like, that's the good thing about being able to do exactly what you want without a record company or whatever is that you can take a minute to get to the chorus, you know. So it's kind of like, from having those constrictions, obviously when we were in Rachel Stamp, we had to edit stuff that was over 4 minutes if it was going to be a single and all that. So not having them at all now, it's just like, I'd rather just take advantage of just doing exactly what I want, really, and not not have to think about the model, you know. The model example of getting to the point with a song, you know, because it might be the point for you, it might, you know, but the intro might be the point for someone else, that might be their favorite part of the song, you know. I think,
yeah, because if you think about it, I suppose the kind of mainstream pop music is going back to a kind of, well, the algorithm is forcing mainstream pop music back into a kind of shape where the songs were the same, or the songs now are the same kind of structure as they were in the 50s almost. You know, they're going back to like 90-second songs where it comes in on the chorus. You might have one verse and then the chorus is repeated.
Yeah, it's nothing new really, is it?
I know everything's cyclical, but then in these days you wouldn't get, I don't know, like a band like Pink Floyd wouldn't be allowed to have however many albums they put out before they got to Dark Side of the Moon. What was it, six albums in or something like that?
It must be, yeah.
You know, you just don't get that anymore. And I suppose that's the beauty of being an independent artist, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. You don't have to worry about any constrictions like that at all, yeah.
And so you play pretty much every, or you have played pretty much every genre from glam rock to ska, electro to pop. What's the favorite style of music that you like to play?
I guess, well, if you're talking actually playing and playing the guitar, I guess, I mean, I just really love catchy kind of power pop stuff, you know, so I'm always striving to go for that. But, you know, I grew up with The Cure and Depeche Mode and all these kind of darker sounding bands. So there's always going to be that side to it as well, you know. So it's quite hard to say, you know, what my favorite sort of style is. I really, my favorite idea of music is just to mix everything up, really, I think, yeah.
And that comes across, obviously, in Scant Regard, I would say. They're kind of mashup between power pop and kind of the more Depeche Mode, Curie type stuff. I think that
I hope so, yeah, that's good. I hope it does.
So what kind of music do you listen to on a day off, for example, or do you avoid music when you're not making it or playing it?
No, I'm always listening to music, really. Like I say, it's like they get everything from dark electronic stuff to the loud guitar power pop stuff, really, yeah. And I like, there's certain bands that I always go back to, like I love a band called The Tubes. I love all their 70s stuff. They just had these crazy live productions, really theatrical shows, really ahead of their time. And in the 80s they became a bit more kind of AOR sounding, but even some of that stuff's pretty good. So I listen to them a lot. You know, I've always loved bands like Aerosmith and just great bands that, where you know the actual sound of the musicians together defines the whole band, really, you know. Yeah, so it's mainly older stuff though, you know, which you just can't get away from the stuff you grew up with, really, you know?
I completely agree. I almost think that whatever you were listening to between the ages of 13 and 20 are probably that's probably the music that you'll go back to for the rest of your life, because it defines
exactly
a moment in time.
Yeah, and also, you know, you can still find stuff from that era that you haven't heard of. You know, it's amazing. Like, the odd band will pop up, some German band or something, and it's like, wow, I've never heard them. And it reminds you of, might remind you of something else you like from then, you know, so it's just never ending, really, yeah.
So what are the artists you're listening to right now? Are there any kind of newer artists, or is it just the older stuff?
What have I been listening to? Just trying to think. I've been listening to a lot of Depeche Mode, probably since Andy Fletcher died, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that was they were such a big part of my growing up. I'm just trying to think, or trying to look what else I listen to. I went to see Gay Bikers the other night because I always used to love them.
Right.
They played a one-off gig in London, so that was good. I've been listening to them.
That's cool.
There's a band called, what are they called? The Vice Rags are really good. They're from New Jersey. That's quite new. That's like a couple of years old.
Mm.
Quite garagey kind of, but nice pop songs as well. I like the new Soft Cell album as well. That's great.
Oh, yeah.
I've been listening to that a lot. It's great when bands like that just come out with something new. Loads of Devo I've been listening to recently.
Nice.
Again, you know, going back to the 70s, like The Sweet and all that, T-Rex, yeah.
Classic. And yeah. I suppose a word as well to Laurie Black, who was obviously opened for Adam and on this tour. I mean, I thought she was brilliant. I don't know how one person stands in front of rooms that big and still is able to command the stage. But then having a look at her background as well, she's in cabaret, so she's used to talking to a room full of people who may or may not be fully into it and kind of getting them on side, which I think she totally did on Sunday night.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, well, it's one thing being experienced on that and being able to do it, but to actually do it properly, yeah, and hold people's attention. And she does that, you know, it's a special kind of talent, definitely, yeah.
Who picked her for the support slot anyway?
That was actually through me, actually, yeah. I recommended her, so... Yep. So, and it's working out well. People seem to really like her. We've got a few more with her coming up, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, I thought she was, I've never seen anything quite like what she was doing, actually, in a room that big anyway, you know, on a tour like that. And I think, it's good to get these slightly more, I don't know what you'd call it, It's not the kind of act that you would imagine opening for Adamant, I guess.
Right.
I guess. I don't know. Like, yeah, it's not the same kind of thing, but I thought she complimented it really well. I thought she was brilliant. And so where did you first find out about her?
That was actually through David from Rachel Stamp. He's a friend of hers. And so I think he played on some of her stuff as well. And I went to see her with him playing guitar with her at the Black Heart, it was actually in Camden. So, yeah, I just thought it worked well. And I think, you know, you say it's not what you'd expect, but I think that's the whole good thing about Adamant, the whole experience is, you know, like to have someone doing their own thing, I think fits him really well with his whole aesthetic, really. So, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Like I say, it's not a criticism in the slightest. I think it's good.
Yeah.
I think it's good to get different types of music on the same bill, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
Different types of artists out there to possibly a group of people who aren't expecting it, you know.
Yeah.
So
no, I think that's good. And she's like, you know, she always comes out and says hello to everyone, and like people have been reacting really well, so it's good.
Yeah, I like an artist who goes down and stands by the merch store. I think that's always a great sign of someone who's doing it for the right reasons.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, got to be done.
Yeah, no, exactly. And especially when you're, you know, if you've got that opportunity to be playing in front of crowds as big as Adam pulls in as well, like, why not make the most of it?
That's it, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I've kept you long enough. You're a busy man. And I really appreciate the time you've given me this morning. But what's next for you now after the Antics tour? Obviously, you were talking about Rachel Stamp possibly organising a tour of the UK. You know, what else is going on in the near future?
Well, this year I've got a few Scant Regard gigs. I'm playing Aces and Eights on the 8th of October. So that's the first one I've got. Then I'm doing this thing, actually a cabaret thing myself. I play this place called the Rock and Roll Cabaret, which is in Soho, Berwick Street, the Blue Post. And that's on the Sunday after that, which is the, I'm glad I've got this in front of me, 16th of October. Then I've got my band, She Made Me Do It, playing The Grace, which is where the garage is. It's like the smaller room of the garage, on the 29th of October. And then, like I said, I've got the Sputnik gig in December. another solo gig right before Christmas. So, but hopefully I'll be booking loads more stuff as well, you know. And I'm also going to be doing a bit of DJing as well. So I'll be posting about that soon because I haven't done that for a while, but yeah.
And is there a singular place? What's the website that people can find out where you're playing and in which bands you're playing?
Well, so, Instagram really is probably the best place, but you know, scantregard.com, that's got all my information about my solo stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, again, Will, thank you so much for coming on today. And I've really enjoyed talking to you. It's been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for your time and good luck for all those gigs for the rest of the year.
Oh, thanks a lot, Tom. Yeah, it's cool. Cheers for having me.
There you go. What a life Will's lived, right? So many bands and so many names dropped. What a lovely bloke. I mean, I feel I was pushing through the chat a little bit fast, but there was so much to get through, and I didn't want to waste too much of his time. Perhaps I'll ask him on again in future to embellish on anything you guys feel like you'd want expanded upon. Just let me know. As I said earlier, you can find Will Crudson on Twitter and Facebook as Will Crudson, on Instagram as ScantRegard, and on his website scantregard.com to keep up to date with who he's playing with and where, from early October through to the end of 2022 and beyond. I really hope you enjoyed that chat, and if there is anything you'd like me to ask on a future episode if he agrees to come back on the show, just let me know and I'll put it to him. If you go and follow him or any of his acts after hearing this, let him know you heard him here first and that's why you're following. As ever, thank you for listening, and until next time, take care. Thank you for listening to this episode of Band Biographies. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. See you next time.
Crackers, napkins, Clorox disinfecting bleach, check. Now roses, what if they wilt?
Attention shoppers, Clorox disinfecting bleach is a great way to keep flowers fresh for longer. It'll even work for that ink stain on your shirt.
Ah, not again.
Clean anything with the versatile Clorox disinfecting bleach. Discover more hacks at Clorox.com/learn.
Unlock big savings during the Menards Bag Sale. Add style and security with Schlage lock sets. Menards carries over 50 styles of interior and exterior lock sets. And with Schlage's wide selection of smart locks and keyless entry locks, there's no more hiding keys under the doormat or losing track of copies. Save big money on Schlage lock sets. Plus, save 15% when you fit it in the bag. Now through January 14th, available in-store only at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.